Hey, y'all. I'm Chase Clements. This is the Support Ops Hangout. This is a show that helps you deliver a better support experience to your customers. We've got some of the best support pros in the business on the cruise. So before we dive into the final episode of this book club, let's go ahead and make sure you know them. So first up, the always awesome Chase Livingston from Automatic. How are you?
Hey, hey. Glad to be back.
Yeah. And then next up, the also always awesome, I guess. That's a way. Yeah, we'll go with that. Jeff Vincent from Wistia. How are you?
I'm good. It's good to be back.
And then Carolyn is missing the first part of the recording here, but she's supposed to show up in a little bit. So hopefully she'll make it. This week, like I mentioned, we're final book of the book club series, and we're going to be talking about Turn the Ship Around by David Marquette. If you haven't seen the cover of the book, here's the here's that. Yeah, that wonderful, awesome thing on the three of you that actually watched the video version of all this. Yeah, so just so everyone kind of knows what the book is about, if you haven't read it yet, this is just straight up from the Amazon summary, since we love some summary stuff. Turn the Ship Around is the true story of how the Santa Fe skyrocketed from worst to first. Also, I love that phrase, from worst to first. I don't know why I like that, like, fun little turn of words. In the fleet by challenging the U.S. Navy's traditional leader-follower approach. Struggling against his own instincts to take control, Marquette instead achieved the vastly more powerful model of giving control. Before long, each member of Marquette's crew became a leader and assumed responsibility for everything he did, from clerical tasks to crucial combat decisions. The crew became fully engaged, contributing their full intellectual capacity every day, and Santa Fe started winning awards and promoting a highly disproportionate number of officers to the submarine command. And I think the kind of the core idea here is this change up. The Navy has forever today used this leader follower kind of model where the captain says we're doing X and the crew says aye aye, we're doing X. When Marquette came in, he basically said, you know, that's just really not how I want to do my ship. We're going to do a leader follower kind of setup instead. You know, giving the rest of the crew more control over what they work on and how they work, allowing them to make more meaningful decisions about their work and how they go about it. And just so people can kind of get this comparison. So if you're leader, you're thinking more longs of like, don't do this, take control, give orders. You kind of have this mentee program that happens. It's very short term, is the way that Marquette puts it. Whereas a leader follower is more longs of like, of giving control, avoid giving specific orders, having conversations rather than having meetings, having a mentor program rather than that mentee kind of setup. So that's the background for this book. Carolyn's here. See, I stalled long enough for you to jump on. How are you? Oh, are you there? Maybe, possibly.
Sorry, I muted myself.
How are you?
Zoom faux pas. I'm good. I'm pretty good. How are you?
Fantastic. Awesome. Yeah, it's the first time the full crew's been back for like a month now, so it's like special. All right, Jeff, let's start with you because you were a big fan of the book. Like, where do you want to start?
Oh, wow. Where do I want to start?
Yeah, we're going to give you like carte blanche. Like, what was one thing that jumped out that you were like, I must, like, this is the one thing I have to tell people about this book?
Oh, I think the biggest, like, the struggle at the heart of this is, which the author doesn't really spend much time getting into except a little bit at the beginning, is that there's got to be, what would you say, maybe 5,000 ships in the Navy? I have no idea how many ships are in the Navy, but there's somewhere between 100 and 10,000 ships in the Navy, and every single one of them is run exactly the same. The captain says, you know, young person, do this thing. And the young person's like, okay, thank you, I will do that. Then there's this one ship where he's like, I'm going to try something different. You tell me what you think we should do, and hopefully we won't run aground. He overcame the fact that had he gone to any peer or any, boss of his, and said, hey, I'm thinking about doing this, they would have said, that doesn't seem like a good idea because I have never done it that way and I'm, winning awards and battles and that kind of thing. I just feel like so many of our businesses are run based on the experience that someone has. Either this is their first time doing it, so that's all the experience they have, or they've hired someone who has great experience at companies X, Y, and Z, and they never did it in that way at any of those companies, so why would you do it that way? I think everyone who has tried to implement change has struggled against a force, an opposing force like that. So I would love to just talk about that and get thoughts from people, like especially the people we have on this panel, because they're from such different companies.
Yeah, and the crew was not really a big fan at the beginning of this, right? It was one of those where they didn't want to have to start thinking for themselves, being responsible for their actions. It was very much like, do the paperwork, do the minimum required amount that I have to do in my little small cog, and then like everything else is somebody else's problem. Walking into that and trying to set that up from like this ingrained, entrenched kind of idea had to be tough. Carolyn, what do you think there? Like, Buffer is very well known for going out and just trying anything and everything, it seems like. If you were at a different company, how do you think that would play out? Like, if you weren't at a company that's so experimental like Buffer?
I've definitely had this experience of people saying, like, oh, well, the things you do at Buffer would never work at my company. So I've gotten to experience that even just being here, like we'll have all kinds of things like, oh, well, yeah, it would just never work. And I think that's maybe partly what Jeff is getting at here. This idea that like, oh, well, I've never seen that work and, I can't imagine it working. Therefore like it's probably a bad idea. And in some cases, a lot of naysayers were right. There was a few cases where we were like, oh yeah, all those people told us not to do it. And that was good advice. But in most cases, people tell us not to do it and it's not good advice. And it ends up being a cool thing. Obviously it depends on how easily you can walk something back. Like if this is a change in this particular example, it was more of just a change of how they communicated and that would have been undoable. So yeah, I've definitely experienced that. I think it's a really tough thing to overcome.
Yeah, Marquette was pretty clear. He, you know, boundaries, the one thing was that you can't, like, if you're going, I think it was like, he said, like, if you're going to fire a torpedo at somebody, like, that's my decision. That's the call I'm going to make. Because as you put it, Carolyn, like, you can't easily walk that one back once it's in the water. but everything else is kind of up for discussion. Livingston, when it comes to automatic, you know, bigger organization here, more along the lines of, you know, a full, so a submarine has like 100 something people on it, 120, 130, something like that. So more than the rest of us have on our teams. Livingston, do you find like with automatic, like the bigger the company gets, the harder it is to kind of have these, have a more loose structure, I mean, a less structured kind of setup for decision-making?
Yeah, I think in some ways it probably is a bit more difficult than, you know, smaller companies, because I guess naturally, I mean, we kind of have to divide ourselves, you know, into teams and that kind of thing just to be able to get anything done. Otherwise, I think we'd all just be sort of spinning our wheels, you know, everybody trying to do everything across the entire company. So, I mean, obviously those divisions are necessary, but I do still feel like, you know, decisions that are made and that kind of thing are usually at least open for discussion among enough people that, you know, we can come to a consensus that's best for the company and best for our users and that kind of thing, depending on whatever the decision is. So it's not like we're, you know, just being told what to do by a dictator or something like that. There are still discussions and, you know, ways for input from us to the people that are ultimately going to, you know, make the decisions and set the goals and that kind of thing that we're doing, you know, throughout the year in the course of our products.
So Matt's not like laying down the law being like this is it.
No, not usually. I mean, he's, I mean, obviously there's some things sometimes that leaders have to do, I think, and it might not be popular within the company, but I wouldn't say I've encountered, you know, I can't think of an example. I'm sure there may have been something in my time at Automatic, but I can't think of one, you know, off the top of my head that, you know, has come down from Matt like that. Normally there's, you know, he's definitely willing to be wrong or willing to, you know, defend an argument or whatever, just like anybody else would be.
Yeah. So Jeff, you've been in charge of a couple of teams now at Wistia. One of the things that kind of kept coming back up in this book was the idea that the head guy doesn't always have all the answers, right? That the manager or whatever just doesn't, you know, wants conversations to happen because they might not have all the information, might not have all the answers, like I mentioned. How do you handle that with your teams? How did you handle that with your teams? Do you, because I imagine it can kind of be a little nervous to like stand in front of a group of people and be like, all right, so I don't know on this one. What do you think?
Well, most people who work on my team know that already, that I don't know. but there definitely is a lot of work to be done. And I think that the author did a pretty good job of walking us through the process of bringing people, sort of to your point earlier, out of their shell of, no, I just follow what you say. So if you don't know what to do, then I'm kind of at a loss. And you have to invest the time. I feel like on the customer happiness team, I was hiring a lot of younger people, people who maybe this was their second job or their first job in tech or something like that. And the test that we had in terms of cultural fit was whether they had ever worked at a place that they would say was not fun. Because then they knew what they were defending. Like they knew that they had to work really hard to keep the culture. And I think that's kind of this, there's a parallel there between they'd work somewhere where they had no ownership. And so when you could introduce them to this concept and get them bought into the idea that they had real ownership, they would protect it, you know, and run with it as much as they could. I'm not exactly sure how I do it or if I do a good job of it. But I think continually going back to people with the question of what would you do and like, what do you think we should do in this situation? Referring to people as the expert in certain area, right? Rather than having everybody on my team be like leverage for me and I become the expert, the Wistia expert in all these areas because of the people who work on my team. It's like, no, they're the expert and you should go to them. I don't know anything about product research. You should go talk to Molly. It's not that just because she's on my team, I suddenly become the expert. And I think that that's essentially what the leader follower model is like, get really good at being a navigator. And then as captain, I'm like head navigator. I get all your powers plus all my experience. And you basically just become an extension of me rather than becoming your own person that I then like that the whole boat benefits from. It's more of a perspective thing rather than a set of processes that I go through to get people on board with that. But it's not easy, that's for sure.
Man, that knowledge thing, that rings true. Like in the beginning parts of the book, he was talking about Marquette originally thought he was going for a different ship, that he was going to be put on on a different boat. So he had done all this study and research and learned it backwards and forwards, left and right. And then all of a sudden he's dumped in a new boat without time to do all of that. Without the time to gain all that product knowledge or whatever you want to call it. So at that point, he had to lean on the rest of the crew because they knew the reactor better than he did. They knew the navigational system better than he did. It was very much the kind of what you're describing. You don't have all the answers in all this because if you did, like, I don't know. I think that's like one of the flaws that everyone talks about when we talk about having mentors, right? Like we expect our mentor to know everything and have been through this before and tell me exactly what to do. Like my wife and I have been binge watching 30 Rock on Netflix because that's what you do during the holidays sometimes. and that feels like some of the mentor setups. It's always like, you know, somebody going to somebody else being like, tell me what to do. When in reality, like being able to work through it yourself and with the help of others that, you know, that process usually ends up with a better result at the end of it.
Can I quote from the book on this one? The line that's jumping out at me from my list of highlights, because it's been a little while since I've read this one, is don't move information to authority, move authority to the information.
Yeah, talk about a little bit, like, why did that end up as a highlight for you? you know, a year ago when you highlighted
it. Right, right. Well, I don't, it makes sense. The thing that it reminds me of now is, and I know y'all three are really tired of hearing me parrot from this book, but listeners of this podcast are tired of this too. But the decision maker model is something that that I've talked about a lot, and it's something that we have used sort of on and off. It's kind of our North Star though for decision making at Buffer, which is you know, there's three sort of pillars of things that you need to take into account when you make a decision. One of those is experience with the problem. And that usually is the lead or an experienced person, someone who's been around a long time, somebody who's seen the ways that that challenges sometimes go. So that usually is you or the lead or whoever it is, experienced with the problem. And then there's people who are close to the problem, which often isn't the lead. And then there's people who are going to be affected by the decision. So two of those three is generally not like the decision, is not generally not necessarily the person who is leading the team. So that gives you two options. Either that person can still be the decision maker, but they get a lot of advice, or you pick a decision maker who's in one of those other two camps or both, ideally. And then you give advice as like that third pillar. And both of those models work really well. It just depends on the need. But that's kind of that. Don't move information to authority, move authority to the information. Like the people who are closest to the problem usually have the best sense of it. And with certain pieces of advice can usually make the best decision.
That's so true. And I think like even I can't pull this sense out of that specific quote, but I can kind of out of what you're saying that now. So at 85 people, Wistia is hitting the point where we could make the leadership team bigger, I suppose, but really like if we tried to control everything that's happening in the business and in the building, like we would be the bottleneck, right? If we had to review everything and sort of give the thumbs up to each little thing, not only are there so many little details that would never get done because there's just not enough room for all those to get approved and for all those to like bubble up, but also we would slow people down as they were waiting for somebody to say, yes, they're like, this is okay. Like go forth. And so it's really incredible to think about the idea that if you can set people on the right trajectory and they're all going for that goal and you trust them because they have all of the context and you hired them because they're really great. Then I guess you can kind of, as the, authority, like you kind of dip in at different points, right? You stop by and you say, hey, what's going on? It's kind of that idea of management by just wandering around. And you're like, so what are you all doing? And they're like, oh, we spotted this problem and we planned the solution. And like, we started running with it. And you're like, that sounds great. I feel like at a certain size, the people who are closest to the problem should be fully autonomous to solve, like have full ownership to solve it. And what's most important from those experienced people is helping fill in the known sort of known unknowns, the things that the people who are about to set forth don't even know about. Mm-hmm. As opposed to having full control over the situation in the old model.
Mm-hmm. Asking the right questions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Chase, when it comes to automatic, again, like we keep leaning back to review just because like, I'm really curious if like this, if it still works as the, you know, team size might be the same, but like as the company grows, you keep adding more and more people. If you have a team that's taking ownership of a problem like that, working out a solution and already running with it, how does automatic know when a team does that, like some other team is not like working on that same problem?
Yeah, I think that can definitely be, you know, a problem, and it's probably happened before, honestly, but that's sort of why we're divided into teams, but then we're also divided into divisions, I guess, and those divisions house each of the teams. And so there's, you know, one division of a bunch of different teams working on WordPress.com, and then another division working on all of our Woo and WooCommerce areas, and then another division that's working on Jetpack, VaultPress, all those premium plugins. And so, you know, at that point, you sort of have somebody who is on the leadership team of Automattic, represented as the leader of each of those divisions. And I think it's sort of their job to, you know, sort of control, you know what's going on amongst each of the teams and sort of figure out who's working on what and even maybe set the roadmap. I know Bo Liebens, who is the sort of the JPOP lead, that's what we call our Jetpack and premium.org plugins, JPOP. He has just recently sort of set some goals for each of the various product teams at Automattic and sort of what they should be working on for at least the, you know, first quarter of 2017 or something like that. And so we're sort of working through that now and seeing, you know, how each of those teams is gonna do that. But that's sort of how we deal with it. I think each team, each division probably has their own method. But for Bo, he's sort of laid out some high-level ideas and things that would be nice to get done in this first quarter of 2017, and sort of up to the teams individually then to make the plans on how they're going to accomplish those goals.
Yeah, I know for Basecamp, one of the things that we use a lot of are pitches, and basically a pitch is a written out message in Basecamp where you identify a concrete problem and then propose a solution for it. And when you have these pitches that happened, you can quickly tell like who's working on similar kind of areas or similar kind of problems, that kind of thing. So it's still the people that are most familiar with the information making decisions about it, but there's still a sense of like shared knowledge or whatever you want to call it, where everyone can see kind of what other people are grappling with at any given time. And we know, so I was talking to Jeff the other day, they just started kind of some cycle work and pitch work stuff and all that. So we're going to come back in a month and see how it works out for Wistia for that kind of thing. So one of the other things that was along the same kind of lines that was really intriguing to me was, and this is one of another one of Carolyn's highlights, because I think she highlighted like all the stuff I was going to talk about, which is perfect. So he said, Marquez says, when I, as the captain, would think out loud, I was in essence imparting important context and experience to my subordinates. I was also modeling that lack of certainty and strength, and certainty is arrogance. Now, what I'm really curious about, and Jeff, we'll start with you, because I want to kind of get like a like an in-person perspective and then a remote perspective. So Jeff, how do you, when you're working with your team, think out loud like this? Like, how do you think your way through a problem? And then right after Jeff, we're going to hit Carolyn, because I want to know how Buffer does it as a remote culture. Like, how do you think out loud remotely?
Yeah, so in person, it's almost too easy, I think, sometimes to do this if the culture's right. And the thing I have to worry about is creating meetings that are too expensive, right? Spending setting up too much time on the calendar with like the entire team. So not only are we getting no current work going, but also we may end up with no progress in our sort of just thinking through the problem work either. So it can be really fun, but it could also cost the company huge in terms of people money.
We need one of those like little clocks where you can like put in everybody's hourly wage and just set it on the end of the table and just like let it start counting.
Exactly. I've definitely run several $1,000 meetings before. And so I think that it's really important in that case to be thinking about what smart people are always saying around creativity comes from constraints. I have no idea whose quote I'm stealing there, but someone very, very smart. And that's like, my job is to set up the bumper bowling lanes, right? To like really define what the constraints are and what the end outcome is that we want. And then let people kind of go crazy, like to really tell people the feedback that I want up front, try to lay out the scenario as much as I can, and then let them run with it for, you know, 30 minutes, like really try to time cap it. And sometimes at the end of a discussion like that, we'll, you know, will agree that we didn't really make as much progress as we wanted. And I'll say something like, I'll take a stab at this, like put up a draft and then I'll share it on the doc and you can rip it apart or give feedback on it or whatever, and build upon it. And as long as people had that little tiny time period with which to contribute ideas, concerns, you know, brainstorm ideas, whatever, they feel more bought into the end solution, even if they don't end up having time to review whatever document I put up, or even if they end up just saying, I would love for us to still see us do this other thing that I had an idea for, but I really don't have any problems with the direction you're going. Let's do it this way. So I think that buy-in is almost more important than having somebody else come up with the idea. And that's how you get it, spending some time together, I think.
Just to piggyback on that really quickly, we do have a lot of transparency, which is sort of the remote asynchronous way to do that, but it is expensive. Everybody reading all the emails or at least filtering through and deciding which ones to read is a $1,000 meeting. Yeah, it's just different ways of achieving the same thing.
Yeah, I'd push back on that. I don't know if it's the same thing. Because thinking about some of the decisions that I've been a part of at Basecamp, when we have like so we'll take a pitch, for example, right? So like a pitch, somebody has identified a problem and they are outlining a proposed solution. That is could easily turn into let's gather up a designer, a programmer, some product person, like a support person, Q&A and all that, put them in a room and talk about that, right? Whereas with our pitches, it usually happens where you can read through the pitch, people that you know, that have insight into that or want to take part in that or whatever will chime in on that thread. But the thread itself tends to be like self-contained and it doesn't take a lot of time to go through. Like, so start to finish, I spend less time going through a pitch thread, message thread, than I would like sitting in a meeting for 30 minutes or an hour or whatever. And I think it's because of the constraints, right? Like it's one of those where I'm constrained by the amount of stuff I'm putting in my comment, the stuff I'm putting in my message. So I have to think about it rather than just being like, well, what if? And then all of a sudden you're off in like a white rabbit hole for 10 minutes in a meeting.
Mm-hmm. Which is expensive, but occasionally is magical.
It's worth it. Right, right. Totally. It's definitely a trade-off there. Mm-hmm. So is that kind of thing expensive, you know, when we talk about the transparency and being able to do all that? Yeah, it is, but I don't know if it's the same level of expense.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
Yeah, I hear you. I think you might be right. There is less opportunity for those like, oh, but what if type stuff, which is a different type of expense, I guess.
Yeah, it's almost like, so the closest like remote kind of analogy I can make is like if I'm sitting in a meeting that is, you know, if we don't have bumper lanes like Jeff was talking about, right? If you just go into a meeting and they're like, oh, here's the problem, we're going to riff on it. It's almost like being in a chat room or something because it can go in so many different directions and nobody's really listening to each other and it's just messy. As opposed to like some kind of, whether it's a P2 thread or a Basecamp thread or whatever you're using, like that message thread where you can go through and concisely like keep track of things and all. Expensive. I just don't know, as expensive as like a chat room kind of thing or an actual in-person meeting. That's interesting.
That is so interesting because I feel the opposite. I feel like it's so much easier to keep a meeting on track than it is an email thread.
Like a video meeting?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, because you can just like mute people or throw up like a...
No, but it's a lot less awkward to be like, to allow the what ifs to happen as long as it's being productive and then be like, so, and bring it back. Whereas a thread can really take on a life of its own and then do, I don't know, in my opinion, it's harder to underail, re-rail a email thread, but...
You need like get tracking for a message, right? Like being able to fork and unfork and
totally.
All right. Last thing on this one, because we're trying to keep it to at least a 40-minute mark on this and not talk about the entire night. One of the quotes from Carolyn, not from Carolyn, but the highlights, it was, why is learning a better word than training? Training implies passivity. It's done to us. We are trained. We attend training. Learning is active. It's something that we do. So Chase, can you kind of talk about this as automatic? Like how, when we talk about, you know, you getting better in your role, your team getting better at what y'all do, is there kind of a mindset more toward learning rather than just being trained?
Yeah, definitely say so. I mean, honestly, even the way we onboard like new happiness engineers and stuff, it used to be when I started, it was more of a training where you would, you know, get on a video call or at least in a chat of some sort or something, and, you know, just be thrown information and or fed information, and you know, you just sort of try to take notes, or I mean, however you learn, and follow along with the trainer or the person who, you know, supposedly has all the knowledge or whatever. And now we've gone to more of a, I would call it more of a learning way of doing things, where we just have sort of a course that that people can go through, and you, you basically just take the information there, you read through it. There's some videos and stuff like that can be helpful to watch. But then you're sort of on your own to learn from the resources that you're given. And you know, some people might call it a trial by fire or something like that, where you can kind of just jump in and learn as you go. I think in some ways that might be the best way to learn, because there's so many, you know, various issues and things that you might run into, that it's honestly probably easier for you to just try to find the information that you need in that moment than try to find, you know, if you were given a bunch of information in a training session, try and go back and parse all that information and try to find what's relevant to the current, you know, problem you're trying to solve for a user. And so that's sort of how we're trying things now, and it seems to be working well. I totally agree with that. Just from what I've seen, you know, my experience being trained, if you will, versus, you know, the new way that we've sort of come up to do things, where you learn what you need to know and go from there.
Hey, Carolyn, so you've moved roles a couple of times, not roles necessarily with Buther, but like job scopes or whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. So with each time, like, do you see this kind of distinction between learning versus training?
For myself?
Yeah, for yourself, yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's always the hardest. So to give you time to collect some thoughts real quick, I think it's not always the hardest for me. It's, you know, you step into a new role and the first kind of thought is, I need to find a book about this. I need to find like some speaker has done something about this. Like what's the resources I can go to? And I guess the argument could be made like that's you actively engaging and like learning new things. But it's tough. I don't know.
Yeah. I'm really glad you bring this up. This was one of my favorite highlights, and of the highlights, you could highlight the whole book, and then of my highlights, there was like a few that I really wanted to talk about, and this was one of them. And like the part two of this, I'm not sure where exactly it is, but it's the highlight immediately after this in the list, mm-hmm. is a briefing is a passive activity for everyone except the briefer. Everyone else is briefed. There's no responsibility for preparation or study. And I think that's really it. Like when you are being trained, it's really hard to prepare for that. It's hard to know what you didn't know. It's hard to identify exactly what Chase just said of, when am I going to apply this knowledge? When am I going to need it? When am I going to be able to put it into practice? Like, have I been in a situation? I haven't yet been in a situation where this would have been helpful because I'm brand new. We have moved that significantly for, we've kind of gone up and down in terms of training we do in happiness at Buffer, because I mean, when I started, it was like, you're alone in your time zone and you have to answer all these emails, like, and you're like go learn everything you need to learn in order to do that. There was like really very little training, because it was a team of two people and one of them was in London. And then over time we realized like, well, that's not the most efficient way to do it. Like some structure is helpful. And so we added a lot more structure onto it, and we did turn it into like a whole training process where you got on and this person taught you how to use Stripe and this person taught you when to use, how to use the admin. And we have tried to take some of this into account now with the happiness training, which is like, yeah, there's certain tools that you need to learn. But in general, like we're going to say, here's a couple of resources, like try and achieve this outcome. And you're going to get stuck 5 times. And that's the point is like, instead of me saying, after I've been talking for 16 minutes about how to use the admin, I'm like, if this ever comes up, this is where you find that. The person's like, okay, blah. But like, it doesn't mean anything. But when they have that experience of going, I don't know where to find this. And then they ask it and then they file that information away in the same part of their brain that they filed the problem and you know, the experience of having that problem. It helps with recall a lot more, I think.
Yeah. Jeff, we'll give you a final say on this one. You dropped out for a second, but we were talking about there, when you kind of get moved into a different role, it can be real tempting to go out and sign up for some course or something that's going to teach you what you need for that role. With you just recently at Wista, you kind of moved more toward a product role and all that. Like what learning, how did you approach learning how to do that role?
Oh man.
That's a whole show in itself, I know, but if you had
my style is the fire hose style. I just try to involve myself in everything I can around it and then assume that certain things are going to stick because they fit with me and like they make sense for my brain. And then I kind of go down that path until someone's like, this is terrible, by the way. And then I change. So I read a lot. I try to find, products. I'm lucky because there's a couple of great books out there. Marty Kagan has a great book. Then I try to, you try to listen. So there's podcasts and audiobooks and all that kind of stuff, blog posts, interview people who do it now, who do the job. There's so many great things out there. For me, with the learning versus training thing, the big, I feel like the buckets that I would put it in is the self-initiated versus the outside initiated learning. Like I'm fine with, I've got teammates who are taking classes right now in product management, but it's all because I didn't go to them and say, okay, so step one is you have to take this training. And then once you complete the training, you get this like bump in your salary. It's great. Like all you have to really do is just answer these couple of questions. No big deal. They came to me and they were like, we heard about this class. We heard it's really good. It costs this much. Here's like a little write-up of what we want to learn and why we think it's valuable. That kind of motivation means they're going to get so much more out of that class than if it was just something that they were going because I had like dangled the carrot of like higher pay. If they just got an A or, a passing grade on the final exam or something like that. So I think the medium is a lot less important than the motivation. And what you want in hiring anyway is people who are self-motivated and they're there because they want to be there and they learn because they can't help themselves.
Yeah. When he said, the training versus learning and that kind of thing, for me, what I heard was passive learning versus active, being actively engaged in whatever you're seeking to make yourself better at. Sorry, Jeff, I said you get the last word, but I just thought about that while you were talking. So
no,
you want the last word? Like, would you like pick a random word?
No, it's a great topic. I think that this book is worth way more than one show. And it's just sad to me that, we don't have enough time. There's just not enough time in our busy schedule. So let's keep the train rolling.
Yeah,
to add to that, I recommended this book to one of my teammates recently, and he had a really long drive home from Christmas. And he listened to the audiobook the whole way. And he was like, it's amazing. I definitely recommend this book. It's so great. So
our entire people management, the people group at Wistia is currently reading and or listening to this for our book club. So I'm really excited. Our last book was Drive by Daniel Pink, I want to say. And so this one, I'm really, really excited to hear what people think.
Yeah, I think so. Like this one, compared to the other, so all of the books that we picked have been great just because, well, first off, our listeners are amazing and they like suggested great books for us to read. But I think what I really loved about this one was the shortness of the chapters. Like they're not bite-sized necessarily, but like you can get through them. They're almost like essays or something. It was kind of reminiscent of Jason Fried's book Rework, where it's just like these little essays that you can kind of go through without getting bogged down. Unlike that long subtitle title from Unleash Creativity. So those are some thick chapters.
Do you get money for plugging Jason's show, or is it more like right around the office thing? Do you get like a t-shirt, or like what do you get for that?
Well, we do have a new book coming out, so you got to like slide it.
No, I'm excited for that one.
Like if you drop it during around the Christmas time, you get a special ornament. If you drop it like around Halloween, you get a pumpkin with Jason's face on it. Like, how does that work?
Oak balls.
Yeah, see, there you go. I knew it.
No, but I will give a shout out to Help Scout, who I'm going to do my Superman impression. After all this long, got me a Help Scout t-shirt, if you can see on the video. So we've plugged them enough, and now we got a t-shirt out of it.
Nice.
Oh, I love those folks. Yeah, so that's our take on this one. Definitely go out and read the book. Turn the Ship Around, David Marquette. Highly recommend it if you haven't already picked it up. It's a great book. Let us know what you think about it. Let us know also what you thought about the book club series in general. We're thinking about kind of ways to do this throughout the year, so we want to get your feedback and your thoughts on how it all worked and what you thought of it. So make sure to let us know. We're at Support Ops on Twitter, or you can hit us up. It's hello at supportops.co. So that's it. We're excited for a brand new year, brand new 2017. So it's going to be a lot of fun this year with lots of great topics and Jeff doing this. Yay! Thumbs up. I should point out, just to throw in really, really quick, I was looking at how other companies did kind of like intro onboarding, like welcome guides and things like that. I ran across Wistia and Jeff's lemonade stand videos. If you have not seen the lemonade stand videos at Wistia, I highly recommend going and watching them because Jeff is fantastic in them.
Will you put the link in the show notes?
Yes, absolutely. That link will be in the show notes.
And as long as we're plugging Jeff's lemonade, if anybody out there knows how to manufacture real goods, I would love to actually start making lemonade. That side company that he references is not real, but I would love to start a charity making lemonade. So if anyone happens to be listening and can tell me how to do that, please reach out.
That's the weirdest thing you've ever said on this entire podcast.
Good. I'm glad to set a new bar. Bring it. Next week, new week. I bet you I'm going to top it.
Oh, you're glad we don't know your like home mailing address because we would just start shipping you lemons at this point.
I would love that.
Here, have lemons.
I think that's the answer. You're going to need to experiment. And
no, I need like someone who knows how to spin up a production line somewhere that I can start using. You can't bottle your, I guess you could bottle your own lemonade, but I wouldn't be married for very long if I turned our kitchen into a lemonade bottling plant.
But first, before you spin out the production line, don't you think you need to get like the ratio of sugar and stuff right? Don't you need to like try a lot of lemonade before you know what to make?
I don't know. I'd probably just follow the real simple catalog or whatever the online. I'm not trying to make the best lemonade in the world. I'm trying to make lemonade that's for good.
I see.
That's the tagline right there. Not the best, but it's real good.
No, it does good. You know what? Never mind. Wrap the show. Play the show.
Play the show. No, it's going out. Here we go. We're going out. And there's no other way to end it. Until we see you next time, have an awesome week.
Bye.